Dr. Heller, as the election approaches, President Reagan and his critics differ sharply on how bad the economy really is and how quickly it may improve. In your judgment, how bad are things and how soon can they be expected to get better?
Well, we're still rocking along bottom. We're still at the highest level of unemployment since the Great Depression, the greatest level of bank failures, the lowest farm income, the highest excess capacity. And while there are a few little stirrings of recovery, with the present situation, I don't think we can come out of this very quickly, though I would not be surprised if we began to see some recovery in 1983, provided the Federal Reserve doesn't stomp once more on the monetary brakes.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Dr. Walter Heller, Regents Professor of Economics at the University of Minnesota and Chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors during the Johnson and Kennedy administrations. Dr. Heller will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Jacqueline Adams, by Fred Barnes, political correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and by CBS News correspondent Fred Graham, who is substituting for the moderator, George Herman. We shall resume the interview in a moment, but first, here is Fred Graham.
Economics is an imprecise science, and economists tend to attract labels, such as supply-side economist, conservative economist, and the like. If ever there was an economist who fit the label liberal economist, it is Walter Heller. Professor Heller, he is currently Regents Professor of Economics at the University of Minnesota, first came to public prominence as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under President John F. Kennedy. He stayed on the national scene as an economic advisor to President Lyndon Johnson and later to President Gerald Ford. Recently, as the more conservative economic theories of the Reagan administration have been invoked as public policy and then have come under public fire, Professor Heller has taken center stage as a critic of the supply-side tax cuts, the tight money credit policies, and the high unemployment rates that have marked the Reagan administration. He is an articulate advocate of liberal economics, and his views have been widely sought. In his official biography, Dr. Heller declares that he has appeared on Meet the Press 13 times on Issues and Answers in Time, U.S. News, Business Week, Corporate Reports, and yes, Face the Nation. And his views have been consistent and cogent, that fighting inflation by depressing the economy and sacrificing jobs is wrong, that tight money and high interest rates are a mistake, and that the large tax cuts and projected huge budget deficits are a disaster. In recent pronouncements, Dr. Heller has disputed the Reagan administration's predictions that recovery is just around the corner. He says an upturn can be expected next spring, but that it will be weak unless President Reagan can be convinced to go along with two measures that Dr. Heller considers essential: increases in taxes and decreases in military spending in order to cut back on the swelling budget deficit. Dr. Heller is married and has three children, is 67 years old, and is still very much in the thick of things. His biography lists two pages of activities, honors, and publications, but only three hobbies: travel, wood chopping, and clam digging.
And now we continue with Face the Nation.
Dr. Heller, in your answer to my first question, you reeled off a fearsome array of things that are happening in the economy that are not good. But I noticed that you were interviewed earlier in the week by a group of print reporters, and you were quoted as saying the following: "The skies will brighten up if we can hang on and survive." And it sounds very much like President Reagan when he says, hang in there and stay the course. Do you really believe that if the public stays the course, things will brighten up next year?
Well, now, let's be clear on what we mean by stay the course. I don't mean that we should, when the Titanic is heading for an iceberg, that we should stay the course. The president's program isn't the thing that's going to get us out of this. What I'm saying is this: that if the Federal Reserve, which, after all, is trying to save the president from himself by easing up some and cutting interest rates, if the Federal Reserve will stay that course, And if we will gradually shrink the deficits as the economy is expanding, then I could see the skies brightening sometime in 1983. After all, recessions do come to an end. People work off their inventories. You have the tax cuts coming along and so forth. Eventually, sure, the economy will turn around. Of course, we wouldn't need a recovery if we hadn't had a recession. I'd like to remind people of that.
Dr. Heller, a year ago in Baltimore, you spoke to a group of Democrats and also gave sort of a semi-rosy picture of the economy then, at least to this extent. You said that Democrats and not Republicans might have some trouble in the election this fall because you said the economy might be recovering. You said that interest rates and inflation would be down and that unemployment might be down. Well, I think you were right on half of those. What happened?
Let me see. I didn't say unemployment would be down. I said that interest rates, taxes, and taxes would be down.
And there would be a recovery on
that. And that a recovery would be underway. And on that, I was just dead wrong. I like to note that over a year ago, my forecasting partner, George Perry at Brookings, and I were among the first to recognize that we were in a long, serious, deep recession. But like almost all other economic forecasters, I had thought we would be recovering by the second half of this year. But the remedial steps that we expected, an easing of money and a more sensible shrinking of the budget deficit so that Wall Street and the financial community wouldn't be so scared, those steps were not taken in time. And as a consequence, I was wrong. The economy is still declining or at least bumping along bottom instead of recovering. And there's no visible recovery for voters to take into account on November 2nd.
You indicated that there are two things really that need to be done to get close to this recovery, and that's keeping interest rates down through Fed policy and also getting the deficits down. But how are we going to do that? The president has said he won't touch Social Security, he won't touch defense, and he's going to keep his 10% tax cut in July. What do we do?
Well, but that's what I mean about staying the course. If the president stays the course, he's heading straight towards that $200 billion deficit, which his advisors are struggling with for 3 years from now. It's not bad to have the deficit that we have right now. I'm not out there, you know, screaming against a $100, $150 billion deficit when the economy's operating way below par. We can stand that. That's not crowding out private investment and credit and so forth. But as the economy moves up again, and as I say, it's almost inevitable that it's going to do that, then that tremendous federal deficit is going to absorb the wherewithal, the credit that the private economy needs. And so we need a sensible scheduling of tax increases and of some, tax increases in the form of, I see you're frowning, tax increases in the form of cutting back the 1983 tax cut, cut back the military buildup somewhat, and cut back some entitlements. I think you have to do some of that. But do it gradually as the economy recovers so that by the time the economy, we hope, gets back to full employment, you'll be running roughly a balanced budget. But that's a tough schedule, especially if you rule out all tax increases and all cutbacks in the defense buildup.
Dr. Heller, there are recessions around the world, Canada, France, Germany, England, unemployment. And these are in countries that have widely differing fiscal and monetary economic policies. Is it possible that what's happening here is just part of a worldwide condition and that blaming it on Reagan and Reaganomics is really misplacing the blame?
Well, I guess I have to answer that in two different ways. One is, yes, we do not live alone. By now, 20% of our manufacturing is done for export. One out of every six manufacturing jobs depends on export. Two out of every 5 acres of our farmland are used for export. So that we can't ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. And you put your finger on the fact that it is a worldwide recession. But the second part of my answer has to be, we are still the locomotive. We can't pull the whole world with us. But if we maintain sky-high interest rates, and our real interest rates are still extremely high, if we maintain sky-high interest rates and an economy that has not grown for 3.5 years, it's tough on all the rest of the world. What we really need is a coordinated policy. We really need to have more sensible worldwide cooperation. We need to use those economic summits for more constructive purposes, but we're not doing it. However, you cannot absolve a domestic administration, either Democratic or Republican, just because the whole world's in a mess.
Well, I want to ask you about that. As a matter of fact, things were in pretty bad shape when the Democratic administration went out, the Carter administration. And the president does make the point that interest rates and inflation have gone down. Now, really, if the Carter administration had stayed in, wouldn't things be in pretty bad shape? And in what regard could they have been in better shape?
Oh, to my mind, had the Carter program, and unfortunately it was rather forgettable, but had the Carter program been enacted, we would be in much better shape today. People seem to forget that Carter, in October of the last year of his presidency, proposed a tax program that made just excellent sense. It was much smaller than the president's program, and it concentrated more of its tax cuts, and this is what people forget, on the supply side, so to speak, on true stimulus of government investment. Instead of having enormous deficits that scared the public and Wall Street, we would have had much more moderate deficits. We'd be much better off today.
Let me go back to interest rates a minute. You've suggested that the Federal Reserve is largely responsible for these high interest rates. Is it wrong to say, then, that deficits, which we've heard a lot in Washington recently, that deficits cause high interest rates?
No. No. The Federal Reserve is, so to speak, the intermediary. It's the instrument. But what's happened is that these out-year deficits that are looming up, as I suggested earlier, you cannot have a $200 billion deficit in an out-year when the economy is approaching full employment without having tremendous crowding out of private credit needs. And the financial markets anticipate that. They look ahead. They don't just operate on today's numbers. They look ahead. So that in many ways, what Reagan did was simply this. He said, now look, I'm going to run the largest defense buildup in peacetime history. And I'm going to put simultaneously, this has never been done before, I'm going to put in the biggest tax cuts in peacetime history. $200 billion for 85, $130 billion buildup of defense for 85. And then I'm going to toss the ball to the Federal Reserve and let them control inflation. Well, poor Paul Volcker, who's one of the ablest of the Federal Reserve chairmen we've had, was put in the position of having to fight the anti-inflation battle himself. And so the interest rates had to go up. Now, don't misunderstand me. I don't want to absolve him. He stayed the course much too long. I think he could have done the easing that he did now, could have done that 6-8 months ago.
But can't this be expected to touch off inflation again? Aren't we just going to get inflation back?
No. Look, and notice, if the credit markets and the stock markets were afraid that it was going to touch off inflation again, as many of the monetarists try to tell us, they would have gone down, not up, because they would have feared the future inflation. When you've got not just 10% of your population unemployed, but 14% when you take the part-timers and the discouraged workers into account, when you have factories operating at the lowest level since the Great Depression, 69% of capacity, you have so much room to put some stimulus into the economy from the monetary side, from the Federal Reserve side, more money, without raising prices. In other words, the response will be more production, more jobs, higher profits, and not higher prices.
You mentioned this unemployment problem. I think that's on the minds of most voters as they're getting ready to go to the polls. How much longer are we going to see 10 or 14% unemployment, and will we ever get back down to full employment?
Well, an economist doesn't like to use the word ever or never, but I think you're putting your finger on one of the most important problems. This is one place, by the way, where Mr. Reagan is right in his assertions about economics. He's so often wrong that it's become almost a joke. But he's right when he says unemployment is the last thing to go down in an economy that's going up. Because what happens is that, first of all, as orders increase, people, the producer, continues to produce with the slack labor and machinery and so forth they had before. So even when the economy starts going up, as it will eventually, very modestly, there aren't very many hires, and layoffs are still, you know, running a couple hundred thousand a month. So that I'm afraid that both because recovery is going to be delayed and because it's going to be modest when it comes, unemployment will rise from where it is now, not fall. And a year from now, it would be surprising if unemployment, the official unemployment of 10.1%, had dropped to 9%.
What about industries like steel and automobiles? Will they ever get back to where they were?
When you take individual industries, and particularly when you're taking sort of high wage areas, I think they are cutting back. That is, the industries are. They are rationalizing, so to speak, modernizing, mechanizing, robotizing. A lot of those jobs will never come back. These people will have to be transferred to other jobs. They'll have to be retrained. And we'll have to have a very intelligent policy over the years of making use of their skills. Right now, they're in despair.
Dr. Heller, how high do you expect unemployment to go, and when?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint, but I wouldn't be surprised if it went to 10.5%, might even go a little beyond that. The really important point, I think, is not so much exactly where and when, but I think it will sort of hover around the double digits for months to come because of the factors that I just spelled out.
You know, one thing that you alluded to a little while ago was the international interdependence and the importance of so many of our jobs that rely on sales overseas. Walter Mondale is now talking a protectionist line, particularly with regard to the Japanese. Do you think that's healthy, and is it wise?
Well, on the specific point of insisting on local content, domestic content, saying that a lot of the imports have to have so and so much domestic content or we'll keep them out, on that point I disagree with him, and I don't like import quotas. But one has to bear in mind that, as he noted in a letter to the Washington Post yesterday, that he puts this in a much broader context. What he's saying is we need to get a fair shake from the other countries. We need to be allowed to penetrate the Japanese markets, and you know how many barriers there are. We need to be allowed to penetrate the European markets. And among other things, he notes that a lot of the protectionist things around the rest of the world are rather subtle. They're in the field of services, like, you know, Norway hasn't given a license to a foreign insurance company in 40 years. There's a lot of subtle things, and he's fighting a much more broad-gauge battle. But I must say, if he thinks that we can create more jobs total by truly protectionist measures, and I hope he doesn't, he's wrong, because you lose more in the export industries than you gain in the import.
So he's making a political pitch right now that to you doesn't make good economic sense.
Well, try to find a major presidential candidate who isn't making that pitch. But read it in context and you find it's a much more reasonable position, except for these points on which one has to disagree even with people.
Except where he's wrong.
Except where he's wrong, yeah.
Dr. Heller, is there a single credible alternative to Reaganomics that most Democrats can agree on?
No, and I don't think one should look for, you know, some easy out. Democrats are criticized because they're all over the map and they don't have a single program. What happened the last time that the outs had a single program? We had the 10-10-10 tax cuts, and we had the 10-5-3 formula for accelerated depreciation. And everybody said, now, isn't that genius to have such a simple program? Simple, neat, and wrong. That 10-10-10 and 10-5-3 is part of what plunged us into this difficulty, so much so that Dole had to take charge last summer and reverse part of that tax cut, especially on business, and the Democrats in the House helped him. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think it would make a difference if there were a substantial swing to the Democrats on November 2nd. I think there'd be more moderation. I think there'd be more emphasis on the little fellow. And little woman, do I have to say that in these days
Probably.
Yes, I will. I think that there'd be more emphasis on infrastructure. By that, the Democrats say you don't slash all programs. You build up some things like bridges and roads and waterways and so forth. And so I think we'd have some moderation in policy, even though there isn't one single Democratic program.
Can you foresee what kind of changes we're going to have in Social Security? There, Congress is supposed to deal with this,
Of course, the president says no, 1,000 times no on any increase in taxes. Some people want to accelerate the Social Security tax increases. I don't really think that's necessary. I think you do need to make some changes in the indexing. We have been over-indexing. We have been over-adjusting Social Security payments for inflation. I think there has to be some adjustment there.
That's a cut in benefits, though.
Well, that's a cut in the that's a cut in the increase in benefits. But we've overdone it. We've done it by the consumer price index, and that's increased a good deal faster than wages out of which the Social Security payments are made. So that's one area. Another area I'd like to see, and I realize that this is not very popular, I don't see why Social Security payments, half of them at least, the part that comes from the employer, shouldn't be made subject to income taxes. Now, the lower income groups would be totally exempt from that. You could, for that matter, put in a floor, $15,000 a year. That would raise several billion dollars a year. So that there are ways and means of doing this without increasing payroll taxes.
Do you really feel that that it can be totally dealt with by... You're not saying cutting benefits. You're saying cutting back on prospective raises. Now, the trust fund is almost broke now, and without raising taxes, you feel that you can make it work, make ends meet?
Well, let's first understand what almost broke means. The Social Security system is taking in about $200 billion a year and is paying out, because of the deep recession, about, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's paying out a little bit more than that. So when you talk about going broke, you're talking only about a slight imbalance. Now they're balancing that out by transfers among the Social Security funds. That won't last forever. I don't mean to minimize the problem. I do mean to say, however, that it's a transition problem. It's a transition because of the composition of the age groups and the fact that the new tax increases have not yet triggered for payroll taxes. And if we can bridge the gap for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, you will find the Social Security trust funds building up very strongly until near the end of the century, and then we'll have to worry about the post-war baby boom retiring. Then we have to do something about that.
Have you found any politicians who are willing to propose to make Social Security benefits taxable?
I have not found them rushing onto my bandwagon on this. No. And why? You know, it's a fascinating thing. This was decided by the Internal Revenue Service way back when. It wasn't even a law that it shouldn't be taxable. The IRS just ruled that it shouldn't be taxable. But it's become a sacred cow. And even the people who wouldn't be touched by it are so horrified by the idea of taxing Social Security benefits that they say, no way. No, I don't expect that to be part of the political solution, but it ought to be.
Do you agree with the Republicans that Democrats have demagogued the Social Security issue in this election?
It's hard to say who's done the most demagoguing. I mean, this is not a place where you can assign blame to either the Democrats or Republicans and take a holier-than-thou position. I don't like the word demagogue, but they've politicized it, yes.
What's going to happen on November 2nd? Will the Democrats have a landslide?
Oh, gosh, I'm an economic analyst, not a political analyst.
But
no,
the economy
I don't
seems to be the number one issue on everyone's minds. Will they blame the Republicans?
I don't expect a Democratic landslide in my own totally amateur way of looking at it because, you know, they say, is it going to be a national referendum on Reaganomics? Well, the president isn't standing for election, and there are a whole lot of, you know, there's hundreds of individuals running for election. If it were a referendum on Reaganomics, yes, I think it would be a landslide because I think Reaganomics to date has failed. But it's more likely that it would be a referendum maybe on Reaganology. By that I mean Mr. Reagan has brought a new ideology into the White House. Transfer resources from the public to the private sector, from the civilian to the military sector. from the federal to state local governments, and then shift burdens from the upper income groups onto the lower income groups. And I think people are paying somewhat more attention to that than they are actually to Reaganomics. Somehow or another, they seem to be willing to give him a longer shot at Reaganomics, even though he got virtually 100% of his program already in the bag, and ought to be judged on that. Then, of course, there's another area which I call Reagan mythology. The number of things that he says that just ain't so on the economy, and the things he takes credit for that he really doesn't, I mean, he takes credit for, example, for the drop in energy prices and for decontrolling oil. Well, that was pure Carter, except for the speed up of the last 7 months. I could give you half a dozen examples.
Dr. Heller, we just have a few more seconds, but do you fear international collapse because of the inability of some nations to repay their debts, a banking collapse?
It's a threat, but it will not become a reality because there are so many different interests to prevent it.
That will prevent it. Thank you very much, Dr. Walter Heller. Our time is up. Thank you for being with us on Face the Nation.